From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, big changes in illegal immigration means new tactics and a new front line.
That border between Mexico and Guatemala, everything crosses. Drugs, arms, people, money.
A documentary looks at how working families struggle with poverty in Texas.
They want what we all want. They want security. They want safety, stability, and good health. And they'll do anything they can to make sure they can provide that for their children.
And despite attempts to control payday lenders, the industry still finds new loopholes to make those high-interest loans. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. There's been a sharp drop in the number of unauthorized Mexican immigrants living in the United States, and the number continues to decline. That's according to the Pew Hispanic Center. Frontera's reporter Aaron Siegel has the story.
The number of undocumented immigrants living in the United States is now estimated to be around 11 million, down from a peak of 12 million in 2007. For 2 years now, that number's held steady. In the year 2000, a reported 770,000 immigrants came to the U.S. from Mexico. Most were unauthorized. But by 2012, that number had dropped significantly, and the Pew Center reports most of those people came to the U.S. legally. Jeffrey Passell is a senior demographer at the Pew Hispanic Center.
By 2010, the flow had dropped to less than 20% of what it was 10 years earlier, or about 140,000 Mexicans coming to the United States. And a majority of them were coming as legal immigrants. So a very profound change in the nature of migration from Mexico.
The study was based on data from the U.S. Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In San Diego, I'm Aaron Siegel.
But as the number of undocumented people from Mexico drops, there is an increase in the number of people from Central America, mainly from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. This development is forcing the United States to change its tactics and move the front line to contain illegal immigration to Mexico's southern border. The independent nonprofit newsroom ProPublica published a new article about the changing shape of immigration. Sebastian Rotella is the reporter who wrote the story, The New Border, Illegal Immigration's Shifting Frontier.
People have an image probably of the U.S.-Mexican border that that's a bit out of date. What the numbers show and what my reporting at the southern border of Mexico with Guatemala shows is that immigration from Mexico is way down, measured both in terms of arrests at the U.S.-Mexican border. You have a lot less Mexicans trying to cross, and other things going on in terms of people going back from the United States, deportations, birth rates in Mexico declining, the middle class growing. You have a lot less Mexicans trying to come across the U.S.-Mexico border, and you have a far greater proportion of people trying to come to the U.S. now illegally who are Central Americans. The number has almost doubled in the past year, and the proportion is close to a third. It used to be a fraction. And these Central Americans are increasingly young. They're people who are teenagers traveling by themselves, and we always have the image of people traveling because of poverty. Obviously, those countries are very poor, and poverty is a factor. But what is striking in terms of what I found talking to migrants and talking to people, investigators and human rights advocates, is that a lot of these people, these young kids, are being driven also by crime and violence. They're running from street gangs. Don't forget that Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador have literally some of the highest homicide rates in the world and some of the worst rates of impunity, that is, crimes that don't get solved. So you have people being pushed by crime and trying to come to the United States and being in incredible danger all the way through the trip. It's very hard, obviously, to get across the U.S.-Mexico border, but it's also just hard to get across Mexico because you have so much crime, so much sort of predatory behavior by the drug cartels and by gangs in Mexico directed at Central American migrants.
In reading your story, I couldn't help but think about the film, the classic independent film El Norte, telling the story of a brother and sister traveling from a war-torn Central American nation through Mexico to get into the United States. That was made in the early 1980s. Is it just that Mexico has become so reduced as no longer providing so much illegal immigration into the United States, or is it that there's so much more growth in Central America?
It's a couple different things. Obviously, Mexico has changed. As much as we think of Mexico as violent and poor, in fact, the numbers show that Mexico has gotten a lot more prosperous. Its economy has grown a lot, and more Mexicans stay in Mexico and are able to find jobs there. At the same time, in El Norte, what you pointed out is a very interesting point to make, because if you remember, that's a story about people, as you said, fleeing from a civil war. In the 1980s, a lot of people from Central America, from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, came to the United States because they were fleeing dictatorships, fleeing civil wars, fleeing like military death squads or leftist guerrillas. Today, those countries are all nominally democracies. They have civilian governments. What people are fleeing is kind of a slow motion war. They're fleeing crime. And so it is a conflict migration. They're almost like refugees, but they're running from violence and crime. And also from, you know, there's also the problem of you have a lot of divided families. So you have people in Central America who came up, you know, parents, people who came up as adults, and you have kids who have grown up most of their lives without their parents. Their parents are in Las Vegas, or they're in San Diego, or they're in Los Angeles, or they're in Washington. And so you have a lot of teenagers going north on their own to try to reunite their families. And it's a very dire and dangerous situation.
So as this information impacts the United States, are our immigration officials thinking that it would be easier to stop these people at the Mexican border than at the U.S.-Mexico border?
That's part of what's going on. Obviously, it's very difficult because that means trying to get Mexico to do enforcement for us. And then Mexico, because Mexico had so much migration leaving from Mexico for so long, it's a very sensitive political issue. But what I found when I was down there is actually the Mexican government is now increasingly concerned about that border because it is so wide open. I mean, that border between Mexico and Guatemala, everything crosses, drugs, arms, people, money. And so the Mexican government is starting to realize as a national security issue, and the U.S. government is definitely talking to them about it, that it's time to impose some control at that border. And there is even talk, and I think this is a sign of how much things have changed, there's a proposal by the new administration of President Enrique Peña Nieto to create a Mexican border patrol, a border police of 5,000 to 8,000 officers that would patrol that southern border. So it's really, it shows you how much times have changed.
Tell us more about the border then. But, you know, it's a river that separates the two, but it's not a whole lot of law enforcement in trying to control the border.
Yeah, it's pretty wide open territory. I mean, it's a 540-mile border, so it's about half the length of our border. A lot of it is, you know, very lush jungle, mountain, rivers territory. A lot of the crossing happens in the state of Chiapas on sort of the southwest corner of that border. And what you have is, as you said, it's a narrow river, the Suquiate River. So in that sense, it's kind of like, the crossing in, say, in El Paso, something like that in Texas. But you have... The difference is you have sort of formal border crossing points with people, you know, with customs and all that, but you can stand on the bridge and see people crossing illegally. It's not hard. It happens in the middle of the day. There's very little enforcement by the Mexicans right on the border. So you see people crossing on rafts. You see zip lines where people actually string lines between buildings or between trees. I saw this while I was down there, and we have a video on the site of people who kind of would these smugglers rig up these zip lines and the migrants sort of slide across from south to north over the river.
What about trying to fix some of the ills that are in these Central American countries, bring about some peace to stop the motivation from them fleeing?
I think that's what a lot of people are talking about when you talk about the Mexican and U.S. and Central American folks I've been talking to over the past months say that for a real solution, obviously border enforcement is one aspect of it, but you know, there's these fundamental problems, as you say, where there's economic development that has to be done, but also, you know, the bottom line, which is true so much through so many places in Latin America, it's not enough to have economic growth or prosperity. You have to have rule of law. You have to have a police that works. You have to have court systems that works. And that's hard to do, but that's where a lot of the energy that groups, you know, the United States, the European Union, the United Nations, you know, a lot of the focus is on trying to build up law enforcement in those countries. But don't forget, you know, that these countries are so used to impunity because of those civil wars, and violence is so ingrained there that that's a very slow and difficult process.
Sebastian Rotella is a reporter for the nonprofit journalism project ProPublica. He recently published an article headlined "The New Border: Illegal Immigration's Shifting Frontier." There is a link to it with photos and a video on our website, tpr.org. Being poor in Texas isn't easy. The state has one of the lowest rates of spending on its citizens per capita and the highest share of those lacking health insurance. It doesn't provide a lot of support services to those in need. Relatively few collect food stamps, and qualifying for cash assistance is particularly tough. And according to the U.S. Census Bureau, in 2011, 17% of Texans were living in poverty, compared to 14% nationwide. And for many, being poor means being working poor, having a job or two, and still not being able to provide for your family. A documentary called A Fighting Chance, produced by the Austin-based Center for Public Policy's Priorities, takes a look at the lives of Texans dealing with the struggles of poverty. Here's a sample.
The first time we had to apply for food stamps and assistance was hard and difficult because we never thought we'd be living in poverty.
The way I viewed Medicaid and, you know, things like food stamp and things like that in the past, and you think, okay, that's just, you know, poor people are on those programs. It never really broke my heart until my son was one of those people that's uninsurable.
We were there pretty much 24/7. Every day they were telling us this could be the last day he's here.
I was making, you know, plenty enough money to take care of my family.
When James lost his job, he had to end up, like, living in motel rooms. We had rats. It wasn't appropriate for the kids, so CPS got involved.
I was on Medicaid, food stamps, and getting housing assistance. Sometimes cereal might have been a meal, just whatever I could think of to put food on the table.
You're okay, Mister.
After Cooper was born, that was kind of just the event that sent everything on a downward spiral. I had to stop working with all of Cooper's surgeries and procedures. Matt had to take a lot of time off work, which also reduced our income more.
My husband and I are out working full-time jobs every day. We work two different shifts trying to make ends meet, and it's not enough for us. It's not enough.
As the doctor's appointments went on and the co-pays came, savings didn't last long at all. I mean, we're pretty much down to nothing.
We're caught in the cycle of not being able to get out of our financial bind and get back on our feet.
If we're not able to keep this place, we'll end up losing our kids. We won't be able to get them back. That's why we're trying to work so hard to find a job right now.
The doctors, they're thinking that he'll be released in the next few weeks. We pray every day for our son. We have a lot of hope that he's going to live a happy life. Really just, you know, live the American dream.
This just shows that one thing can happen to a family and it can change everything completely.
That's a clip from A Fighting Chance, a documentary produced by the Center for Public Policy's Priorities. It focuses on the struggles of families in Texas dealing with poverty. The documentary will air on public television stations across Texas. Francis DeVinny is a researcher at the Center for Public Policy Priorities and is a co-producer of the documentary.
In the documentary, A Fighting Chance, we're following five Texas families who are coming from all walks of life. We follow one family who actually was living comfortably in middle class, and then they were confronted with a medical crisis in their family, and one of the parents had to quit their job, and that kind of just sent them spiraling and downward for their family economics. Another family worked construction and lost a job during the recession and talking about their experience. Another family both parents work full-time currently, and they work 40 hours a week and still can't make ends meet. And so it's talking about the different pathways to poverty, but really trying to dispel the notion that families living in poverty are any different than families who are not living in poverty, in that they want what we all want. They want security, they want safety, stability, and good health. And they'll do anything they can to make sure they can provide that for their children. So really, kind of first and foremost, poverty is a place where nobody wants to be. And that's kind of what we're trying to share, is that picture and get that, you know, face behind the numbers that we always talk about.
So we really examine how many of us are really just a paycheck or two away from being out on the street or having some major difficulty in providing for our family.
Absolutely. And, you know, it, even for many, several of the families that we follow in the story talk about how they had savings. They had savings put back. But when you reach a crisis, be it a job loss, something resulting from the Great Recession, or some other kind of crisis that your family hits that's more personal, those, even those savings that you put back can disappear pretty quickly in trying to keep up with your basic expenses, food, rent, gas, you know, and it's so easy for us to fall into poverty. And so what does that mean for us as a society? Where do we need to go to try to fill the gaps between poverty and making it? What kind of choices do we need to make to help families kind of live the American dream?
And you think that many people in Texas are not aware of this, that they have a perception that if you are somehow accepting public services like food stamps, then you are a welfare queen?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a big debate between personal responsibility and shared responsibility. And as a Texan, you know, it's in my DNA. Responsibility is a key part of what it means to be a Texan and be an American and build the American dream. But it's not just about personal responsibility. The short stories that we share in the documentary, every single one of those families takes immense personal responsibility in trying to do everything that they can for their families to build up economic security and to protect their families and get them the health care they need or provide them the food that they need. So, and personal responsibility can't get there alone. It takes shared responsibility from our communities and from our state to say, you know what, in Texas, we believe that you should have the opportunity to be able to move ahead no matter who you are or where you start or what's happened in life.
So we start off with these families and we look at the crisis that they face. Is there a happy ending?
There are happy endings, actually. It does actually kind of have an uplifting moment. One of the families that we highlight is a story of Dolores. She lives in Bryan, Texas, and her family. And she's a single mom and lived in poverty and had to live in public housing for a while. And while that wasn't her first choice, she knew it was an opportunity that could allow her to build up some security for her family. She got connected with the Family Self-Sufficiency Program, which is a federally funded program to help get her some economic education, and got, she's now working toward getting her bachelor's degree. And she has a full-time job and is now a manager's position at a pharmacy. And has great aspirations and has bought her own home and is looking to get her master's degree one day. So hers is certainly a very promising story and an exciting story, but also the other families have uplifting stories too, where because of their perseverance and because of the opportunities they've gained through additional both public supports and community supports, are finding additional jobs, finding new opportunities. And so it's kind of tracking that path and showing how when we support each other, we can all move ahead.
Frances DeVinney is a researcher at the Center for Public Policy Priorities and is a co-producer of the documentary A Fighting Chance, which tells the stories of Texas families living in poverty. It's expected to air on PBS stations across Texas. One place where Texans can turn to when they run low on funds is the Corner Payday Loan Outlet. This happens particularly during the holidays, but paying back those quick and easy loans can be long and difficult. It's a poverty trap that local governments like San Antonio and Austin have tried to control with city ordinances, but because of state laws that benefit the highly profitable payday loan companies, they're still operating and charging those mega interest rates. To get a close-up look at how the payday loan business worked, Texas Observer reporter Forrest Wilder decided to get one himself.
Yeah, I decided to take out a payday loan because I've been writing about the payday loan and auto title industry in Texas for a while now. But I did, you know, I've heard stories from folks about getting into trapped into these loans and the problems with them, and covered what's happened to the legislature attempts at trying to regulate the industry. Wanted to experience for myself what a typical retail experience would be for a consumer. Just questions about how easy would this be? How would they answer questions I would have about paying the loan back? You know, how they sell the loan or loans to somebody who walks in the door. And it's really hard to know exactly what that's like without just going and doing it yourself. So being a secret shopper, in this case, for a payday loan.
So you went into a corner store and asked them for a loan for $1,500. Was there any kind of liability on your part? Were you afraid that you may have been suckered into something that you'd have to pay back interest and things?
Before I went, even thought about taking out a payday loan, I talked to some experts and made sure that I would be able to cancel it without paying any sort of fee or penalty. And in fact, the state law stipulates that you can cancel a payday loan within 72 hours of taking it out without any sort of penalty. So unless a company wants to break the law, they have to let you to say, you know, I decided I didn't want this, and then they cancel it.
Yeah, but we find out in your story that they have found out some interesting loopholes within loopholes that are kind of scary, that are hard on consumers. I mean, is the experience that they make it seem so easy that you can take out the loan and the payments are going to be so reasonable that people do take out these loans and bite off more than they can chew?
Yes. What I discovered was that this one chain called the Cash Store, which is based out of Irving, Texas, has found a way actually around what minimal rules and regulations the state of Texas has imposed on payday lenders, as well as more stringent ordinances that have been passed by the cities of Austin, San Antonio, and Dallas. They technically are not offering a payday loan, even though the average consumer would have no way of knowing that. It's an installment loan, one that I took out, due in 10 payments over a course of about 5 months. I took out a $1,500 loan, and the finance charge, which consists almost entirely of fees, was...
You would have had to pay back $2,362.23.
So, yes, I would have. My principal was $1,500. That's how much they handed me in cash. And I would have owed them, if I had paid everything on time, about $2,400. Well, that works out to about 612% effective APR. So a really high credit card rate, for example, would be, you know, 27% or something like that. And this is...
You know, for a mortgage right now is under 5%.
Right. Now, of course, the industry says these are high-risk customers that we're serving. These are short-term loans that, you know, your typical single payment payday loan is only for 2 weeks. But again, I think what's especially interesting and new about this loan product that I took out is that this company, just by making some very small technical changes to the loan product, is able to escape regulation by the state of Texas and the city of Austin.
Did you feel at any point that they misled you or anything? They were pretty open about how much this was going to cost you and what your burden was going to be.
The one thing that I thought was potentially deceptive, or at least, you know, it could be for some people. When I asked about the rate on a couple of occasions, she said we charge 20%. The rate that I think most people would be talking about, and in fact the rate that was disclosed and must be disclosed in the contract under federal truth in lending rules, was 612%. The 20% she's talking about was the 20% per installment period. There's 10 installment periods, and each one, you know, is about 20%. But what people really care about is the total over the life of the loan, which again is 10 two-week periods, and that one is 612%. So I was asking explicitly about the rate, and on two occasions, the woman in the source referred to this 20%. You know, in a legal sense, I don't know if that's, you know, allowable or not. But from my perspective, it could be very confusing for your average consumer.
Forrest Wilder is a reporter for the Texas Observer, and he's been covering the payday loan industry in Texas. You can read his articles online at thetexasobserver.org. The promise of renewable energy is being fulfilled. It can be cheap, dependable, sustainable, and clean. This coming week, the Texas Renewable Energy Conference is being held, and being honored is Austin Energy's former manager, Roger Duncan.
There is a United States State Department program called Energy and Climate Partnership of the Americas that President Obama instituted. And as part of that program, the U.S. State Department sends energy and climate experts to Central and South American countries to help them, particularly with transition to renewable energy and energy efficiency. As a part of that program, I went to Honduras in the spring and just came back from Chile about a month ago. Talking to the government agencies, the electric utility generators, the renewable energy organizations, discussing with them some of the issues that we have when we transition a large electric system from fossil fuels to renewables. There are unique and specific problems of integrating renewables into the electric grid. And I dealt with some of those as general manager of Austin Energy and in my work in the past with renewable energy.
Is there great excitement in Latin America for these? I would imagine in Chile they would have access to geothermal energy.
Chile is moving forward right now with some large wind farms, and they also have a large solar resource in the northern desert region. They have some geothermal potential. They also have wave ocean potential along their long coastline. So all the countries are in different stages of moving to renewables, and according to the state of their electric utility grid and resources, it's at various stages.
Where is this taking this? What's in the future for us here in Texas and also Latin America?
The future everywhere is first a transition to renewable energy from fossil fuels, and that will take some time. It's not going to happen in we're not going to be living off renewable energy as the majority of our fuel in the next few years. But everywhere there is a transition and has to be from to renewable energy from fossil fuels. At the same time, we're starting to embed intelligence in our grid, in our appliances, at our homes, in our meters, and the connection between things like the transportation sector, where we have electric cars and more intelligence in the cars, and automation in our buildings and the electric grid. All of that is coming together in what we are calling a unified electric system and a unified energy system. And that means that all the sectors of our energy, the buildings and the power plants and the transportation systems, are starting to talk to each other now and to move power back and forth. It may be solar on your roof. It may be a hydrogen-powered car. It may be a large wind farm on the utility side. But they're all feeding into a system that is moving energy and information back and forth.
Roger Duncan is the president of the Pecan Street Project, a smart grid initiative. He is being honored this week at the Texas Renewable Energy Conference. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website at tpr.org. And you can subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.